Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 788, January the 12th, 1987. If you want information on how to obtain back broadcasts or how to subscribe to regular broadcasts that are mailed out with the bibliography sheet that accompanies it, you can write to me, M-A-E, it is Brussel, P.O. Box 22511, Carmel 93922. For those of you who listen off the air and do not subscribe to the tapes through the mail, I may discontinue the bibliography sheets unless you show some kind of activism in a way that you're using them. I'm tired of stuffing envelopes to know that they go somewhere in a drawer and are not used for purposes for which they're intended. I would like to see you write to members of Congress, to investigating committees, letters to the editor, and call talk shows that are in the major cities. Most of the cities have all-day talk shows, the larger ones. And I think that you should be using the information in some way. Otherwise, I'm not sure that I want to spend my time that could be used in other ways just filling envelopes with bibliography sheets. Now, in Monterey County, we're having trouble again with frost ban with Advanced Genetic Sciences. The firm wants to have a new testing out here in Hollister. They've planned that, and they're seeking permission, not permission, but they've announced that frost ban will be sprayed. Last year it was stopped until March of 1987, and they're ready to come back with that live genetic altered bacteria for the first time in this area. It would be tested here. They've been using it in other places, actually around the country. And up at Tule Lake, they have the projects called Ice Minus, and the people up there are objecting to putting this frost ban on potato plants. They're told that there's no problem to plant or animal life, and people don't want to be guinea pigs in the case. Contra Costa County in California, whoever's speaking for them, one particular man, Elgin Martin, has 110 acres of pears, and he said this past week he's not afraid of bacteria tests, that they can do it in Contra Costa County. But just about the same time that he said that, one day earlier, there was an article on cancer rate up in five Bay Area counties, and the lung cancer was the worst in Contra Costa County. And I predicted years ago that they would probably be target for cancer experiments and possibly from food that was handed down at the time of the SLA program. And I don't think it's just coincidental. I know the air is bad and all that, but Contra Costa County is one of the worst. It is the worst in the northern area for lung cancer. And a spokesman is saying, come on, bring on AGS. Let's try our luck one more time. Before I get on to ContraGate, I want to just mention several disturbing articles that can't be ignored. One is called Trouble in Paradise. White supremacists in Idaho mar the Los Angeles police retirees' tranquility. That's the name of the article. December the 14th, 1986. And I'll do a lot more for you on this. But the gist of the article is that 30 members of the Los Angeles Police Department have settled right next to Aryan Nation's founder, Richard Butler, who wants that northwest area to be an all-white state, is designated as all-white. And veterans of the police squad who attacked the Black Panthers or worked a SWAT team that burnt and took care of the Symbionese Liberation Army, these former policemen are now up in Idaho with Richard Butler. Now, Richard Butler was an engineer at Lockheed working on the U-2. He calls himself a minister, and he wants to take over the world and kill all the blacks and Jews in the world. And the LAPD was described by Lewis Tackwood, who worked for the Squad 19 and the very people that were involved in the SLA. He said that the LAPD wanted to form a Gestapo. And it's very dangerous that up in Hayden Lake, next to Mr. Butler, are 30 members of the LAPD who worked attacking the Black Panthers and on the SLA project, because SLA was a totally created fabric of the Defense Department, the FBI, Ronald Reagan, and Ed Meese at the time. And these two factors, the LAPD and Ed Butler, 30 of them up in Idaho, is a very bad sign. Also, there was an article in People's Daily World, January the 6th, U.S. arms thefts tied to the Ku Klux Klan. And what is happening is the extreme right-wing forces that link directly to our military and to Mr. Butler from Lockheed and to Mr. Pierce, who worked for United Technology and for the Air Force, who is the head of the Nazi Party in the Eastern area in Washington and in Virginia. They are taking weapons and missiles and various things to overthrow this country and giving them to the Klans and the Nazis. And the taking out of these armories for these agencies is a very bad sign because they link directly to Mr. Butler, who formerly worked at Lockheed. Also, there was an article came over Reuters this past week, January the 4th, Souvenirs at Hitler's Resort called Nazi Nostalgia, and it tells about Berchtesgaden Garden and surviving the Eagle's Nest, the people down below, and how they have a souvenir shop and they sell pictures of Adolf Hitler and so forth. But one of the things that was interesting here was that they plan to have the 1992 Winter Olympics at Berchtesgaden Garden, and they're already selling these pictures of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi era. Well, last week I talked about the importance of Fritz Kramer, the secret team. I've been doing that for 16 years on the air, but now it's really heating up. But you can say for all purposes, now Ronald Reagan is through. The team isn't out. The work is to get rid of the team, but Reagan is through. The game is over. The handwriting is on the wall. The article, the two articles that I'm citing for proof of this or evidence of it, one is from Roland Evans and Robert Novak, the very two people it wrote last week that the sun was shining because the National Security Council was retaining Fritz Kramer, and this strategic arms specialist Kramer would never be sacrificed while others moved out as they cling out the NSC. 7 days later, they wrote for the Washington Post and the Houston Post, the Reagan presidency is dead. And the article says that key aides are buoyed up by the ratings, congratulate themselves on their survival, but the reality is that Reagan is dead. I'm afraid it's all over, said a mournful conservative, and the public's long love affair with Reagan has lost its magic, and he is on the way out. And when they say that, you can be sure that that is the sign to move him out. Who is next? And they're pushing this Pat Buchanan presidency for all it is worth. Incidentally, I received the Washington Post article about Fritz Kramer, and it's different than the Houston Post. The Washington Post syndicated column refers to Fritz Kramer two times. One, the Washington Post rather leaves out one of the paragraphs that is in the Houston Post, which I think is significant. The Washington Post says, on top of the that clinging out the National Security Council and putting in Mr. Ehrmarth and Sorzano, hardline arms control specialist Fritz Kramer unexpectedly is being retained, and they never mention him again. And in the Houston Post, the same article says he, Mr. Carlucci quickly gave up cleaning out the NSC because it would have sacrificed the high talent that he has, including strategic arms specialist Kramer. Now, that sentence was left out of the Washington Post. I took the two articles this week side by side, and no paragraph or word was left out. So it isn't a question of space, but Kramer's name was only mentioned one time. The other omen, the second omen, that there's trouble in Washington has to do with an article I read in New Solidarity December 19th, files on gunrunner Hashemi sought in court appeal. Now, the gist of this is Cyrus Hashemi was murdered in London this past July. He's one of the connecting links to JINSA, J-I-N-S-A, the Israeli organization that is part and parcel of our own Defense Department, along with Mr. Cherba, who's closely tied to the Mooney organization, and Michael Ledeen. But the interesting thing about this article, there's a lawsuit to get the records of Hashemi that were filed a couple of years ago, and the Justice Department held them up, and then the case was refiled, and because of the story of the RAND gate breaking with Mr. Khashoggi and Mr. Hashemi, and Hashemi is one of 17 defendants who were sending arms to Iran and mentioned George Bush on their tape recordings and in their trial. But the interesting thing about opening up this case of Hashemi, Khashoggi, the Israeli Mossad, and so forth is the article said that an attorney by the name of Bernard Fensterwald III is representing Edward Spanaus, S-P-A-N-N-A-U-S, to get these papers in the open. Bernard Fensterwald was the attorney for James McCord at the time of Watergate, also Marianne Paisley of the CIA when John Paisley died. And when Bernard Fensterwald comes into a case, I was waiting to see when he would open into the Iran-Contra gate, because then the chips begin to fall and spread along the side, and certain people are able to spin off, some fatally, some career-wise and otherwise. But it was Fensterwald who took McCord to Judge Sirica's, or vice versa. They went together. And when McCord said, there are things going on here in the Justice Department, in the White House, in the CIA, these various lies, and I want to present my attorney, Bernard Fensterwald. So when Fensterwald gets into this case, that is the biggest similarity to Watergate so far. And the story that he is going to take, he says, to the Supreme Court, is a very big piece of this whole Contragate, Irangate scandal. The article I saw this in came from Richmond, Virginia. It says the FBI's continuing cover-up of the Iranian gunrunner and Khomeini-backed terrorism is at issue in a case appealing the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit Court here of Edward Spanius versus the Justice Department. Hashemi died under mysterious circumstances in July in London. He has surfaced in the news recently as one of the purported middlemen of the 1986 arms deal involving Saudi dealer Adnan Khashoggi. Hashemi is, in fact, one of the key figures involved in arms trafficking to Iran, going on through Zbigniew Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter since 1979. This lawsuit involves information on Hashemi and the corporation that put Hashemi into business, the First Gulf Bank and Trust Company, which was set up by Merrill Lynch in Switzerland. The money came through First Gulf. Hashemi's involvement in the 1970-80 hostage crisis, in the 1980 assassination of anti-Khomeini spokesman Ali Tabatabai, illegal weapons trafficking by Hashemi, and it also involves former Justice Department official J. Stanley Pottinger and the FBI's losing of the tape recordings of Pottinger representing Hashemi. Elliot Richardson of the Justice Department was a lawyer for Hashemi, and Pottinger was also a lawyer, and Pottinger was on the board of one of the two corporations, or both, that Hashemi set up in Panama and down in Central America with the money, as I say, coming from Donald Reagan's Merrill Lynch. Now, this article is a bombshell. I'll do more details on Hashemi and the links to Michael Ledeen, to Jinsa, to the generals in Israel, the Mossad, to our own Defense Department through Mr. Cherba, their links to Reverend Moon. This is a very important story, just like the Evans and Novak one, that Reagan's presidency is dead. The next one I saw this week of importance was the one of Fensterwald taking the case to open up the Hashemi case, and he says if the court doesn't open it up, December the 10th, the oral argument of Attorney Fensterwald said, representing Mr. Spanaus, an attorney who has this attorney representing him, he told the three-judge panel the case should be remanded and sent back to the district court for rehearing. And following the hearing, Fensterwald said if the Court of Appeals denies the Spanaus appeal, he will take the case to the United States Supreme Court. And that will be an interesting day. I also have an article, many of them along this line, why did the Justice Department protect the drug pushers? This is about Fidel Castro, who has Robert Vesco living in the Caribbean, going in and out of Cuba, and now the Justice Department protected Robert Vesco all this time with his drug running and the patronage of a Carlos Leder, L-E-H-D-E-R. And the case involves the bank of the Compagnie de Services Fiduciaire, which is a Swiss consulting bank located in Geneva, Switzerland, which is the bank that Robert McFarlane used and the 208 committee used and for their trips to Iran and the money that was put in there. And it also has to do with Edmund Safra's Republic National Bank. And I've done broadcasts on Safra and Donald Reagan and Henry Kissinger and investments down in Brazil. This is a ball of wax that also involves Albert Hakim and Richard Secord from Stanford Technology that was set up from TCI, Otto von Bolschwing's network, out here in Palo Alto. And it goes into the Zucker connections. I have large articles to share with you, and there was a huge one in the Wall Street Journal this past week called The Zucker Connection, who runs CFS, this bank that is causing so much trouble because of all the missing money. Where did $10 million go here? Where did $2 million go, or another $10 million? And Willard Zucker is a leading participant in the connecting link between Albert Hakim and Richard Secord of Stanford Technology, formerly TCI, and also the links to Robert Vesco. Zucker joined Bernie Kornfield, his investors overseas services. And I suggest if you want to know some of these intricacies, get several good books or paperbacks on Robert Vesco and read those. And it has to do with Kenneth Bialkin of the Anti-Defamation League and some top Israelis, and also John Singlaub and the World Anti-Communist League, Ariel Sharon and Alexander Haig. So when Fensterwald opens up those papers, just sit around and watch the feathers fly as they did in Watergate. The Houston Post had an article by William V. Shannon reprinted from the Boston Globe, Kansas City Times, titled "Challenger Disaster Was a Grim Omen for Reagan." And that's what I said the minute the Challenger went up. And those tapes or the telephone conversations of the White House of the National Security Council have never been released to find out who caused the Challenger to go up in the cold. And after that, it exploded and hydrogen leaked through the O-ring. It couldn't hold in the cold weather. This article says the six-year jinx that befalls many two-term presidents hit Ronald Reagan with full force in 1986 on January 28th in the morning of the day of which he was to have given his State of the Union message. The space shuttle Challenger disintegrated 73 seconds after launching and seven astronauts were killed. The Challenger disaster was a grim omen of the year that followed Ronald Reagan. The full story of why it was sent up on the fateful day has not yet been told. The secrecy and manipulation of information that have characterized the administration from the outset were to produce severe political damage by the president's year. And he had to face that, and they had to work with the Challenger explosion and hired William Rogers, who's a law partner, William Casey of the CIA, and Alton Keel, who from the National Security Council was the liaison of Rogers to the White House. Keel's now gone on to NATO, and he's taken the place of Mr. Abshire from the Georgetown Center of Strategic International Studies, who is now at the White House covering up messes there, and Abshire wants to become CIA director, and the Challenger story was the first accident. This article says, and remember the chronology I gave you of the worst stories of the year in February, the Marcos were driven out of Philippines, and of course William Rogers and William Casey, the office of Rogers and Wells, were the bankers for the Marcos with their corrupt money in New York City and Panama and Cayman Islands. Then they go on to the Libya bombings, April 15th, and that was the Department of National Security Council disinformation. And they cite the Statue of Liberty observation, a event mixed with patriotism and sentiment. And that's when we displayed the first ship that sailed, that Liberty belonged to Adolf Hitler. It was his ship. And the Chilean torture ship was the fourth in line for that grim parade. Then they referred to when Reagan met Soviet Chairman Mikhail Gorbachev and Rekovich, and that's when things really began to come down. Whatever happened to Rekovich and the Danilov story are kingpins in pulling the plug out of Ronald Reagan, stories that were building up all through the year. The article is titled, "Challenger Disaster Was a Grim Omen for Reagan," Kansas City Times, January the 1st, 1987. Now, there's a few items, stories I'm going to go through very quickly with you. I'm not going to cover the details or names. Most of the articles I'm going to run through just to show you what's in the news just this past week that has accumulated. Most of them I've put on paper 10 by 14 inches. There's so much material, and we'll take those articles later in depth. I just want to run through them as quickly as I can. One funny story was the Muslim Swami linked to arms sales. Canadian investors tied to a religious leader who advises the Sultan of Brunei. This cast of characters is so unbelievable, with the Mossad, the generals of Israeli intelligence that's supposed to be so smart, working with Saudi Arabians like Khashoggi, and organized crime and drug running and death assassination teams are all tangled together. But when you get into an element that Ronald Reagan never imagined, like working with the Iranians in the Middle East, people in the Muslim, the Swami, whose money is being used and they can't find it, a lot more is going to come out besides Bernard Fensterwald representing a case to open up the Hashemi gun running to Iran. This is a crowd that you don't lose a gambling bet with of $5, much less $10 million here, $2 million there, and another $8 or $10 million here or there. A story from the Los Angeles Times, January the 8th. Dealers may have lost big. Iran scheme cheated financiers. They may have lost millions. Reagan is in real trouble when you get into losing millions. As I say, you don't play this kind of game unless you know where you're going to get the money. Another long article from the Washington Post by Michael Isikoff, January the 4th. And you might, I hope you tape these off the air, so you can play back the sources. I'm not copying articles. People write me letters and say, send me this article. I simply do not have time to do it. I'll give you the source and date. You have to go to the library yourself. Deals of developer Khashoggi building frustration in Utah. Millions are sought from Utah, where there are about 500 or 50 to 500 lawsuits. He was going to build this huge Triad America. He dug a hole that was so big that it's next to the Mormon church, and it's excavated. There's nothing going up there. He was going to put a $600 million building downtown, anchored by two gold-colored 43-story office towers. He's left town, and the lawsuits are piling up, and there's debts and demands for over $100 million in unpaid notes and bills, 47 different lawsuits, and 100 people were laid off just from the Triad Corporation, 100 people with homes and rent and so forth. This is a long article, not only 10 by 14, it's 2 pages in the Washington Post, how angry in Utah they are and how it's affecting the economy there. The San Francisco Examiner had a story, along with the New York Times. It was interesting because when we get into the case of Mr. Channel and political money to overthrow those electorates that are against the Contras or that are against Star Wars, there were other political machinations, going on all this time. An interesting story, January the 10th, from the San Jose Mercury, Dominelli ruling sets code for election ads. The gist of it is this, that financier Jay Dominelli, who's gone to jail for absconding with millions of dollars. The fine on the law of William Rogers and William Casey was $40 million, just fine. Dominelli took a lot of money, goodness knows where it is, and ran, and then came back. And this is a suit that was set in San Francisco, charging that the J. Dominelli Company in 1980 blasted President Carter on the eve of the 1980 elections. And he had ads in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Chicago Tribune, and put all this money. Allegedly, he didn't work with any particular party, so it wasn't authorized by a particular candidate to run against Jimmy Carter. But now it turns out, or it turned out this past year, that Dominelli's lawyer was Casey, who would become CIA director. He was managing Ronald Reagan's campaign in 1980, at the time the Carter papers were gone, the Carter Gate, the time that Michael Ledeen was pulling the Billy Gate, and the hostages were kept in Iran under promise and deals, hold them until Reagan is elected. And so on top of those machinations between Channel's offices and the Carter Gate, Billy Gate, and the money to Iran for weapons, it turns out that Dominelli, who said he was acting alone in San Diego, actually was not acting alone. His lawyer was the man who gained the most by becoming the CIA director. He gained a lot then. He's not gaining a lot now, but he thought he would hold on to a lot. So I have an article that I had on the air a long time ago about the Dominelli case. This was in February 21st, just at the time the Challenger case was going on and William Rogers was investigating the Challenger. In the explosion on the Challenger, the mishap when 7 died. And at the time I had this story from New York Times, Rogers and Wells has agreed to a $40 million settlement with investors who charged the law firm with securities fraud, negligent malpractice in connection with the representation of Jay Dominelli in San Diego and his fraudulent investment scheme collapsed in 1984. Another law office, Loeb & Loeb in Los Angeles, lost $28 million in the scheme. But the point is that the soon CIA director, William Casey, who was the manager of the president's campaign, Ronald Reagan's campaign, his client was placing ads in the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and other papers around the country on why you shouldn't vote for Jimmy Carter. I think this has to be looked into in the election Iran scam, and we have to get this to the committees in Washington while they're looking into these other matters. Now, who are the people in Washington doing the investigations before we start sending them letters? I want to do a little bit about several areas that many of you have seen these articles, some of you haven't. One is on Lawrence Walsh, the new chief prosecutor for investigator for the Iran Gate, Contragate stories. The story about him is from the Washington Times, by Mr. Doyle. This is a Mooney paper. This is what they have about Lawrence Walsh. I want to talk about him and Mr. Carlucci and the team in the White House protecting the president now, because all three of them seem to be of the same fabric, and they have to be watched very carefully. The article says, Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel investigating the Iran-Contra affair, was the director and lawyer for nearly two decades, 20 years, of a pharmaceutical company whose prescription drugs allegedly caused birth defects and cataracts. Richardson Merrill Incorporated, Wilton, Connecticut, admitted in 1964 it supplied the government with falsified laboratory documents about its anti-cholesterol drug MER-29 in the court. This is a lawyer that worked 20 years for Merrill Richardson when they presented falsified documents to a court. The article says the firm spent tens of millions of dollars in related costs by the late 1970s and early 80s to keep Benedictine, another drug, a morning sickness plagued by litigation claiming it was linked to birth defects, on the market. In 1980, Richardson Merrill paid Mr. Walsh $3.3 million for his fees to protect the drug company. Mr. Walsh left Merrill Richardson as director in 1981. He was chosen as independent counsel last week. His Office of Public Service included posts of Director of the Waterfront Commission in New York's Harbor, Deputy Attorney General, and negotiated Vietnam peace talks. Since 1961, Mr. Walsh worked as a defense lawyer for corporate clients. Merrill Richardson was among his chief. If he got that many million, he's a very rich man, $3.3 million, and there's a lot of sick and deformed people. Extensive biographical notes made public by the U.S. Court of Appeals, as well as his listing in Who's Who in America, don't mention his ties to the pharmaceutical firm. He began as an outside counsel for Richardson Merrill soon after he left the Justice Department in 1961 to become a partner in the blue-chip Wall Street firm of Davis, Polk, and Ward Will. He was a board member of Richardson Merrill, the drug firm, in 1964. He served on the board of directors until 1981, according to the company records. He was a minor stockholder in the company, and then it was acquired by Dow Chemical in 1981. He still holds stock. Merrill Richardson's market performance through the 60s and 70s, while he was their chief attorney, was clouded with three problem-ridden prescription drugs, thalidomide, MER-29, and Benedictine. Thalidomide, a sedative administered to pregnant women, was not developed by Merrill Richardson, but the firm was a U.S. licensee. It tested the drug on the domestic market in 1980 by dispersing millions of samples to physicians and sold the drug in Canada and also in Germany. For those of you who are too young to remember the thalidomide case, that's when children were born with fins, sort of like sea mammals with no arms and legs, and it was a horrendous case. And I have a book on the thalidomide, which it was hard to obtain. It's very hard to get that book, and I can see why. The people involved in defending it have to move up and take care of investigations like this. The article says, in June 1960, Merrill Richardson marketed the drug MER-29. They developed it in-house to reduce cholesterol. The side effects were cataracts, vomiting, loss of hair. It was taken off the market after the FDA inspectors seized a federal grand jury investigation and a record that the grand jury was going into it. Merrill Richardson and three executives pleaded no contest in 1964 that the company falsified their lab records on animals. They were only fined $80,000. Walsh also represented not only Mayer, that was a subject of 500 civil suits. The company paid $200 million in damages, according to an October 80 issue of Science magazine. The controversy over Benedictine began to flare in 1978 in Orlando, Florida, where a couple filed a $12 million lawsuit against Merrill Richardson because of their son's birth defects. Mr. Walsh was chief defense counsel of that lawsuit, which became the first Benedictine case to go to trial that involved 3 years of multi-million dollar pretrial. The case resulted in a $20,000 jury verdict to pay the boy's medical expenses. Richardson and Merrill began selling Benedictine in 1956. It was the only FDA drug for morning sickness. It was nearly 2,000 damage claimed and several hundred claims overseas. Richardson Merrill was dissolved in 1981. Its over-the-counter product became Richardson Vicks, and the drugs division was acquired by Dow Chemical. Richardson Merrill stockholders, including Mr. Walsh, received Dow Chemical stock, which he now gets and earns a lot of money from that. And the article goes on to say how the price doubled at Dow and he made a lot of money in addition to legal fees. But the chief prosecutor for this case was heavily involved in protecting victims of drugs and evidence that was suppressed or not put out right in order to cheat people of the money they would get as a result of having to take these drugs. The next person will go into just one item or one long article and several others to back up this one has to do with Mr. Frank Carlucci, the new man in charge of our National Security Council. I think we better take a one-minute break before I get into Carlucci because there's a lot of material on him, but I want to show you the quality, the fine quality of Ronald Reagan and the best investigators there to get to the bottom of the matter. As I say, we'll take a one-minute break and go right on to Frank Carlucci.